And before I start the teaching, I'm going to pray. Father, I thank you for this opportunity to teach the message that you have given to me. And I pray that only your words will flourish and bear fruit. And if anything comes from my own opinion, from my own mind, or any part of me, I pray that that will fall to the ground and not even be remembered, but that only your words will be remembered. I pray, be with us in this teaching, and I pray that people will who hear this will get an understanding of the coming in gathering, which is so much like now what the children of Israel are going through in this Torah portion. And I ask this in Yeshua's name. Amen. Okay. So I'm going to address in this teaching our preparation for the coming in gathering. And I will talk about the method of the in gathering as well. So we want to ask the questions, how can we be prepared to meet our King? How will he gather his people from all over the globe? Well, there is a plan, and this plan is generally not taught in the church, and sometimes it's not even taught in Messianic Judaism or in Hebrew roots. And sometimes when it is taught, it is misunderstood. So we need to understand this plan, because what is happening with Israel in this Torah portion is going to happen to us in our wilderness experience. But I'm going to start at the beginning of this Torah portion before I move into the understanding of the in-gathering. We have now a newly formed nation, which has taken over a year at Mount Sinai to formalize as a nation. And now this nation has 13 tribes. We read in Naso last week, and Rick taught last week about those 12 tribes that were dedicated to Yahweh's altar. That was 12 minus the one that was there, which was the tribe of Levi, which 12 plus 1 is Levi, but Levi was left out of that dedication last week. So this week, Levi will now have that tribe's own special dedication. And I'm going to just briefly make this statement because I've been dealing so much with this topic. This special dedication should have been done for all the firstborns of Israel, but the golden calf. Exodus 32:1, I'm going to touch on this briefly, said that when the people saw that Moses delayed to come down out of the mount, the people gathered themselves together to Aaron and said to him, "Up, make us gods which shall go before us. As for this Moses, the man that brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we don't know what has become of him." So, this golden calf incident is the reason why the Levites are now replacing the firstborn. But I want you to notice something in here, and it's something that I have not brought up before. This scripture says the people asked Aaron to make the image. It does not say the firstborns asked. Why is this? It is because it is the people's responsibility in Israel to make sure their leaders are leading them correctly. You know, we like to blame everyone else for our going astray, but the truth is that we let ourselves be led astray. Each and every Israelite has a special calling on his or her life, which includes the requirement to have a personal relationship with Yeshua, the King of all Israel, from the beginning in Genesis 1, at Mount Sinai, on the cross, where he paid the price for the sins of Israel, and ever since. And since the scripture does not say it was the firstborns who asked for the golden calf image, why then did they lose their rightful place to serve in the tabernacle? This is important because it's going to tell us what is our responsibility, personally, to the congregation. It was the job of the firstborns also to step in and stop the sins of the people. You know, this is something that Israel never has gotten right. The people will not stop their leaders from leading them into sin. You know, everybody has the responsibility to know what Yahweh's law says. Every person needs to be an expert in the law. And they need to say to their leader, hey, wait a minute. Now, you don't just, you know, go to that guy and start beating him up. You say, hey, wait, look, I see this in the scripture. I think there's something here that maybe you should not be leading the people to do this. But the leaders also, the firstborns also, have even a greater responsibility to say to the people, not going to do that. So you see how this works. The people have the responsibility to stop their leaders from leading them into sin, and the leaders have the responsibility to stop the people from leading Israel into sin. And I dare say that the incidences which we are now having with the complaining and all of the rest of that would not have happened. Those 10 tests in the wilderness would have come out with different results if everybody had been doing their own personal responsibility to stop others from sinning. So we each have a personal mandate of responsibility to stop other Israelites from sinning against Yahweh. And if we don't do that, there can be horrible and irreversible consequences for failing in this. Ultimately, on the ground, someone pays the price for what the people ask for. And in this case, it was the firstborns who paid the price with the loss of their honor to serve the king. And then, of course, Yeshua had to come, and he had to pay the price with his life because Israel did not do what it was supposed to do. So now, the non-Aaronite Levites, those who are not from the line of Aaron, will take their place alongside Aaron and his sons instead of the firstborns. So this principle of being responsible for each other will now carry over into our end times preparation, being in gathered and preparing to meet our King. If we do this, we will not fail. In fact, Paul tells us that in 1 Corinthians 10, he tells us that what happened in the wilderness is our example of what not to do. And, you know, we're going to be successful this time around. Starting in Numbers 8, verse 5, is the ceremony to dedicate the Levites instead of the firstborn with the water of cleansing. And they were also to shave their bodies from head to foot, wash their clothing, because there are no uniforms for them. So they had to wash their own clothing. This shaving was the same instruction for the leper who was to be cleansed, and it represents a new beginning, a fresh start, and it represents the replacement of the firstborns. Being properly cleansed is an issue that comes up over and over again in the Old Testament, and especially in the Torah. It was in last week's portion. It appears again twice in this portion. And in a few weeks, we will be given a red heifer's ashes for purification in chapter 19. Leviticus 11 to 15 provides the commandments for staying tahor, clean, before Yahweh. Staying clean was at issue all through the Old Testament in the history, prophets, and even in the wisdom literature. And it will be important for Yahweh's fleeing woman of Revelation 12:6, who will, during the tribulation, wash her robes in Yeshua's blood, which will then need to stay clean afterwards. We must understand what this means because it is our responsibility in our relationship with Yeshua. And I'm currently working on a teaching about the laws of clean and unclean, so I'm not going to go into all of that today. But before we get to the subject of the ingathering, let's look at some other scriptures briefly. Chapter 8, verses 1 through 4, about the lighting of the menorah. These are not a mere repetition of the menorah lighting as was given in Exodus 25:37. These are a more detailed instruction of that commandment. The Aaronites have just been ordained, the tribes have been dedicated, and the Levites are about to be dedicated, so that from now on, Aaron and his successors will have the job of lighting the menorah. And Yahweh wants us to know how this procedure is done and what it means. The menorah is the most important furniture in the holy place. Its light dispels the darkness, and that's the point. The tables of incense and showbread, which represent our prayers to Yahweh and the tribes, you know, in those 12 loaves of bread, would be in darkness without the menorah. So Yahweh has no intention to let us be in darkness. In fact, he sent his Son to be the light of the world so that we would not be in darkness and without hope once the temple was destroyed. So literally, Yeshua is the menorah. The menorah is Yeshua. So getting and keeping the lamp lit is a very important principle because of the light which permeates the darkness. And that is part of John's gospel message in the first chapter of the Gospel of John, isn't it? Starting in Numbers 8:5, again, is the ceremony to dedicate the Levites instead of the firstborns with the water of cleansing. Now, this water of cleansing is different from the water that cleansed the leper. And this cleansing water is a conundrum for some Bible scholars. The leper cleansed himself in plain water, mayim, and his bird sacrifice was done over running water, kai mayim. But the Levites were cleansed by purifying water, kata'a mayim. Some people think the purifying water in this ceremony is the red heifer water, but the Hebrew words for the red heifer water are different for the cleansing water. The red heifer's water is called mayim nida, the water of separation. So no one really knows what the water of cleansing was. It probably was water set aside for this special ceremony, which was used only this once. The dedication of these Levites would stand for all later generations of Levites. The tribe of Levi will always have their portion serving the temple because they are a gift to Aaron in Numbers 8:19. A gift and a calling once given by Yahweh is irrevocable, according to Romans 11:29. Now, starting in Numbers 9 in this portion, we have the issue of being unclean for Passover. What happens when a Passover comes around and we are not clean? This problem was not addressed by Yahweh previously. But some men had touched a dead body within the 7 days prior to the feast and were unclean according to Yahweh's law. So what were they to do since there were no specific instructions for this situation? Well, they went to Moses, and Moses went to pray. The answer was that Yahweh gave the men the grace of a second month Passover in Numbers 9, verses 10 and 11, to be observed when we are unclean by a dead body, or we are on a long journey, meaning we are not physically in Israel for the regular Passover in the first month. And by the way, this is a wonderful example of grace. This is not part of my script, but I will stress this a little bit. Grace is given to Yahweh's people who are obedient. Mercy is what you need when you've been disobedient and you have to throw yourself on the king's mercy. Mercy is required when there's been deliberate sin, there's been rebellion, and so forth. There's no sacrifice for that. So you have to go face to face with the king and ask him for his mercy. And we can read about David asking for forgiveness and mercy in the Psalms, you know, for when he sinned with Uriah and Bathsheba and all of that mess. But here, Yahweh not only answers the concern for a dead body, but he inserts instruction about being on a long journey. This was not asked. The question was, we're unclean. What do we do? Nobody said, we've been on a long journey. What do we do? This is also a prophecy from Yahweh about a particular long journey that his people will one day go on. What long journey might that be? Exile. Exile is an example of being on a long journey. But let's not get confused and think that in our exile, we are to skip the Passover in the first month and keep it in the second month. We should memorialize Passover in exile, but we must also not celebrate it the way it would be celebrated if we were in Jerusalem, which is the only authorized place for us to do Passover. So what then can we do to memorialize Passover? Well, we can do what Daniel did when he was in exile in Babylon. We can fast and pray and mourn during Passover. That's in Daniel 10, verses 1 through 4. And we can follow Zephaniah's prophecy, which says that Yahweh will gather those who mourn because they are not able to attend the feast. That's in Zephaniah 3:18. Being ingathered from Babylon was predicated on this attitude of mourning, yearning to keep Yahweh's feasts in Jerusalem. The rabbis had taught the Jews to keep Passover in their homes while they were in Babylon, and this Babylonian tradition continues to this day among the Jews, among the Hebrew roots people, among the Messianic Jews. We don't realize that we're doing Babylon when we keep Passover and celebrate it in our homes in exile. But that is not Yahweh's instruction, is it? Daniel knew that the only place where he could keep Passover was in Jerusalem. Daniel was of the priestly class. And likely there were others who knew it also. We don't know about them. But, you know, Daniel, he wrote a book. And those other people did not write a book. And so he has a book and they don't. But we can take the cue from Daniel on this. Now, the prophecy of Zephaniah 3:18 has both a near and a far fulfillment. The promise made there applied to that generation that was going to be mourning to go back to Jerusalem for the feasts, and it's going to apply to us at the end of days. Our Passovers and even our other feasts in exile should be done in mourning, not in celebration. We can still teach our children through our mourning. In fact, our children will get a better education about and a better understanding about what it is to be in exile. You know, they will learn that what we have done is we have failed to understand Yahweh. If we mourn for the feast, and that exile is punishment, not celebration. Now, what about those unclean men during that first Passover? What were they doing during that first Passover? Well, we don't know. They were not allowed to keep that Passover. The scripture doesn't tell us anything more about them, but if we do some reasoning, we may have a few ideas, and from these ideas may come a clue about what it was like for them not to be able to do the first Passover. First of all, they were not with their families at the tabernacle. And perhaps they ate the manna that had fallen in the morning, but they did not eat the lamb. Perhaps they ate nothing. Maybe they were in mourning over being left out of that first memorial, that first Passover celebration. I mean, think about this in the terms of America. Most of the people in here are American, but everybody in this room, even the non-Americans, will have this experience. You know, you've had some kind of an independence happen. And the following year is going to be a celebration of the independence that you won in the previous year. That's going to be a big deal. Well, the year before, these people had gained their independence from Egypt. And now these poor guys, they are not going to get to partake in that. And I don't know about you, but that would make me incredibly sad to miss that celebration. Well, whether or not anything that I've mentioned about this is the case, it was probable that they were not having the best time. Maybe they even gathered together for moral support, but nonetheless, they were left out of the celebration, which was not a happy time. But that fits with Daniel and Zephaniah about the mourning for the feast when we can't keep it, even when we think we're going to be back in Jerusalem for the second Passover. You have to ask yourself, why was the problem of being unclean for the Feast of Passover not addressed already by Yahweh when he gave the law? Didn't he know this could happen? That there could be instances when people would be unclean from any number of reasons to come before him? You know, the men who must present themselves 3 times a year. Didn't he know there would be instances when men would not be able to because of uncleanness? I mean, didn't Yahweh foresee every situation that might arise because of his commandments and people trying to implement them in his life or in their lives? Well, of course, the answer is yes. Yahweh always knows what can and will happen when his people begin observing his law in their daily lives. He knows that the best way for us, though, is to do his law, because it's going through a learning process wherein such questions arise and our experience answers the question for us. It is the learning process that shows him that we are willing to obey and be engaged with the law. Asking questions is how a teacher knows that the pupil is listening. So Yahweh wants to know, are you listening? So he leaves it open so we can be engaged with his law, which also is and means that we are engaged with him. Now, I am using that word engaged because it has to do with his bride and her coming in gathering. We are currently engaged, betrothed, to be married. We are his betrothed, and we must begin to understand the need for every part of his law in our lives if we expect him to go ahead and marry us. And even if we don't understand all the parts of the law, if we are trying, that's the part that counts. It's the willing heart that counts. Yahweh is teaching us to make his law a part of ourselves through our engagement with the learning process. He could have given us volumes and volumes of scenarios and the application of the law on those scenarios, but he would rather have us to learn to apply the law through our own learning and coming to him to pray, so that we can learn to apply it in our lives and to adjudicate his law, to make righteous judgments based on his law. This is training. The men in Numbers 9 asked Moses what to do, and the answer was to pray for Yahweh's answer. That is always how we are to proceed when we have a question about the law. Pray, and I'm going to add here another word, study. So you go to the giver of the law because it is part of our personal relationship with him, and it is also part of our personal responsibility to each other, as I said in the beginning when I was explaining the responsibility that the people had to the firstborns and that the firstborns had to the people. We are responsible to each other and for each other. So this is training designed to draw Yahweh's people to him through prayer, while simultaneously removing the evil from the camp, as Moses taught throughout the book of Deuteronomy in chapters 13, 17, 19, 21, 22, and 24. So now we're going to talk about the ingathering. And this is the method of the ingathering from our long journey, from our exile. Yahweh promised that his ingathering in the end of days will be so much greater than the first Exodus that we won't ever speak of the first one again. Jeremiah 16:14. Therefore, behold, the days come, says Yahweh, that it shall no more be said, Yahweh lives, that brought up the children of Israel out of the land of Egypt. But Yahweh lives, that brought up the children of Israel from the land of the north, and from all the lands where he had driven them, and I will bring them again into their land that I gave to their fathers. How will Yahweh's people be gathered from the north, which is Europe, the original place where all the tribes were scattered, and then, you know, out around the world, wherever they are, how will they be gathered? He has a way, and it's told to us in Scripture how he's going to do this. How will he bring them to the wilderness where the first generation was tried and failed? And one other question. Why is the wilderness that they were in called the wilderness of the people in Ezekiel 20? Well, let me address the last question first. For years, I have heard Hebrew Roots teachers tell people that when the tribulation starts, go to the last place that you kept Sukkot. Well, that's going to be their wilderness, these teachers say. Nothing could be further from the truth. The many gathering places all over the earth, which may or may not be the last place that you kept Sukkot, and if that's where you kept Sukkot, you disregarded that, and you did it against Yahweh's express command to be in Jerusalem for the feasts, those many gathering places will not be the ingathering place, and it will not be Ezekiel's wilderness of the people in Ezekiel 20:35. Ezekiel uses the terminology of the wilderness of the people because of the ingathering of Yahweh's people from all around the world, from the many nations, and because the prophecy was about the end of days when the area is no longer called the wildernesses of Zin, Paran, and Kadesh Barnea. Those wildernesses were the place where Yahweh tested and tried the first generation, and that's where we're going to be gathered to. That's where the ingathering is. These were located in Edom and Moab in what is now called Southern Jordan. It's not in the U.S., it's not in the Australian outback, the mountains of Italy, or in South Africa. The wilderness of the end times generation will be the same place as the first time. Yahweh will not change his pattern to make the wilderness be just any old place where you happen to land on the earth. Instead, the ingathering will be in the same place it was before. And right now, in Edom and Moab, which is southern Jordan, there are servants of Yahweh who have been called here to start preparing for his woman to come out of the world and to be nurtured as predicted in Revelation 12:6, which says the place will already be prepared for her. Now, I know that this is true because I have heard the testimony of other people who are here. And this is that's what they say. Yahweh called me. I'm here to prepare for this woman. That's what he called me here for. That's what Yahweh called Michael and me here for. We are preparing for you all to come out of the world and be ingathered here so that Yahweh can meet with you here, face to face, here, like he did the first time. So, places of so-called ingatherings around the world are not the prepared places where Yahweh's woman will be nurtured. But that brings up the question about how will she arrive in the wilderness. Isaiah 4:5 says, Yahweh will create over all the site of Mount Zion and on her assemblies a cloud and smoke by day and the shining of a flaming fire by night, for on all the glory shall be a defense. Yahweh's woman will have the same pillars of cloud and fire as at the first Exodus. And there will be these pillars over the place of Zion, which is called Temple Mount today, for the protection of those who will be left there when the tribulation starts. There's going to be people in Judea and on Temple Mount who will still be there when the tribulation starts. And those who are trapped there will be protected by this cloud by day and shining flame by night. This is one of the things that make people think they have to get to Temple Mount in order to be ingathered. But let's proceed here and see if that's true. Isaiah 4, 3 and 4, which comes before verse 5, says, It shall be, he who is left in Zion and he who remains in Jerusalem shall be called holy, even everyone who is written among the living in Jerusalem, when the Lord shall have washed away the filth of the daughters of Zion, and shall have purged the blood of Jerusalem from its midst by the spirit of judgment and by the spirit of burning. But what about those who are not on Mount Zion, on Temple Mount, or in Jerusalem? Isaiah 4:2, which comes even before verses 3, 4, and 5, says, In that day shall the branch of Yahweh be beautiful and glorious, and the fruit of the earth excellent and comely for those who have escaped from Israel. Those who have escaped from Israel will also have pillars of cloud and fire. Why? Because in verse 5 it says, Those pillars of cloud and fire will be on the site of Mount Zion and on her assemblies. The site of Mount Zion is one assembly. But there are going to be assemblies, plural. So these pillars are what is going to protect people around the world. By the way, when the folks came out of Egypt the first time, what did they have? They had the pillar of cloud and fire. These pillars were protection from the enemy in the first Exodus, and they will be the same in the second Exodus. And as I said, we know this because of the wording in Isaiah 4:5, which says the site of Mount Zion and all of her Zion's assemblies will have this protections. Folks, we don't need a rapture. We will have the same pillars of protection and leading this time that we had in the first generation. From all over the earth, Yahweh's people will be led by these pillars just as they were the first time. Zion's assemblies will be away from the site of Mount Zion in Israel. And the promise is that the pillars of cloud and fire will be on Zion. But Zion is not just the mountain. It is the people. Isaiah 51:16 says, And I have put my words in your mouth. Yahweh is telling Isaiah, I, Yahweh, have put my, Yahweh, words in your mouth, and I have covered you, in the shadow of my hand, that I, Yahweh, may plant the heavens and lay the foundations of the earth and say to Zion, You are my people. So Yahweh's people are called Zion too. Therefore, all of Zion, Yahweh's woman, along with Temple Mount and Jerusalem, will have the protection and provision of the pillars of cloud and fire in their fleeing to the wilderness of the people in Jordan, to Edom and Moab, southern Jordan. Now, you know, it's interesting. My friend Rick, who's on this meeting, sent a vision by A.A. Allen, I think was his name, this past week. And he was seeing, I don't remember how he described it. This is way back in 1954. He was seeing the destruction of America, and as this destruction was happening, he was seeing puffs of smoke. And I realized that those puffs of smoke might just be the pillars of cloud that he was seeing. I don't know if that's true or not, but it has come to my mind. This time in the wilderness, there won't be a tabernacle unless Yahweh raises up the tabernacle of David for that time, which, you know, Amos 9 tells us about that, but we don't know when that's going to happen. So it's possible we will have a tabernacle of David. But we do know that there will be assemblies of Zion, both on Mount Zion and on Zion the people. And the prayer of Moses will go before them when they pull up their stakes to leave the wilderness of Sinai, which metaphorically means wherever you are located on the earth, to head toward the wilderness of Kadesh Barnea, Edom and Moab in southern Jordan, which Ezekiel called the wilderness of the people. Let's go to Numbers 10:34 in this week's Torah portion. And the cloud of Yahweh was upon them by day when they pulled up stakes out of the camp. And it happened when the ark pulled up, Moses said, "Rise up, Yahweh, and let your enemies be scattered, and let those who hate you flee before you." And when it rested, he said, "Return, O Yahweh, to the many thousands of Israel," also known as, later on, as Zion. Guess what's going to happen? When the leaders who are now out around the world, and I think that's probably going to be perhaps the 144,000, I'm not sure about that, but whoever is leading those, all those little tiny assemblies from all over the world, when they say, "Rise up, Yahweh, and let your enemies be scattered, and let those who hate you flee before you," that means your camp is going to split the enemy, and you're going to walk through. The purpose of the pillars, as I said, and by the way, before I say this next thing, isn't that what happened? In the past, Pharaoh's mighty army could not permeate Yahweh's pillar of fire or his pillar of cloud. These people are not going to be able to stop Zion, Israel, Yahweh's woman, from getting to the in-gathering place. We don't need to be lifted up in the air and transported. You'll get here. Yahweh's going to make that way for you. The purpose of the pillars, as I said, was to protect the people from their enemies. But another purpose was to lead and guide them to the wilderness of the first generation, which will be, as I said, the wilderness of the people in Ezekiel's last generation. So, again, that's going to be Edom and Moab, which is the ancient wildernesses of Zin, Paran, and Kadesh Barnea. And just realize that the people had many stops, according to Numbers 33. Before they reached Kadesh Barnea, where they finally failed their tests and where Yahweh told them they would not go into the promised land, but that's not going to happen to everyone. The rebellious people of the end times also, like the first generation, will not be allowed to go into his promised land, as Ezekiel told us in chapter 20, verse 38. So you see, this end time scenario will be exactly the same as in the first generation, with the exception that there will be many pillars of cloud and fire protecting and guiding his people instead of just one pillar, as at the first generation. Yahweh will remain true to his pattern which he has established. So please, do not believe any teacher who tells you that wherever you are, you will be in the wilderness of the people. Yahweh will also provide food for the people as they travel, just as he did the first time. But we must be careful to not do what the first generation did in this Torah portion, which was to complain about it. The complaint about the manna was just one of the 10 tests that the first generation failed. And like I said before, Paul said these tests were given to us as examples for the last generation in 1 Corinthians 10:11. Numbers chapter 12 is Miriam's specific complaint about Moses, which she spread to Aaron. Chapter 12 is a continuation of, or the result of, the events in chapter 11, the complaining over the manna, which led to Moses complaining, which led to the 70 men prophesying, and then Miriam complaining against Moses about that, you know, don't we get to prophesy? I mean, we're right next to Moses. Why don't we get to prophesy? Let's understand that the extension of that situation in chapter 12 is to complain against Moses by complaining about the law that Yahweh requires us to live by, which he gave Moses to teach us. Whether our complaint is against Moses personally, which is not going to be possible because he won't be with us in person at the end, or against the law that he wrote for us on behalf of Yahweh, we must not speak against him in our travels under the pillars of cloud and fire. Such complaining will cause delays in travel, as it did for the Israelites while they waited for Miriam to return to the camp after 7 days. And those complaints will gain the person who complains the reputation of being a complainer, and that is not a reputation we want to carry with us into the wilderness of the people, where we're going to be judged by going under the rod. By the way, everyone has to be judged. Everyone has to die, and then comes the judgment. We're going to be judged in the wilderness. Some will not pass the judgment, and they will not be allowed to go into the promised land. It says that in Ezekiel 20, verse 38. So let us keep from profaning Yahweh's name with images like the people and the firstborns did. Let's keep from being unclean. Let's learn the laws of clean and unclean, especially Leviticus 15, 11, Leviticus 11 through 15. Let's stop doing the feasts in the wrong way. Let's stop complaining and so that we don't complain in the coming wilderness, and cause our complaining to have us not accept Yeshua's correction from the rod. Let us instead humble ourselves to do what Yahweh said so that we may find ourselves worthy to escape all these coming things. Luke 21:34. So be careful, or your hearts will be loaded down with carousing, drunkenness, and cares of this life. That's the more likely one for us who walk with Yahweh, the cares of this life. And that day will come on you suddenly, for it will come like a snare on all those who dwell on the surface of the earth. That includes us. It'll be a snare. It'll come suddenly. We right now see what we think is coming, but Yeshua said it's going to come like a snare. Therefore, be watchful at all times, praying that you may be counted worthy to escape all these things that will happen so that you can stand before the Son of Man. And that concludes this week's teaching.